Chicago Police Superintendent David Brown is joining us, and thank you for being with us. You were hired to this job about 3 months ago. That first day, you're coming to Chicago to accept the job, and that plane is landing, and you're looking out over this city, knowing all of the violence and the trouble that this city has seen throughout decades, let alone this year. What went through your mind?
My first week, I remember the first Chicago police officer passed away due to COVID. And as I'm being sworn in, two more officers are gravely ill here in Chicago, and they pass away in the days as I get sworn in. And it really has this so shocking effect. And just to give you an idea, over 700 Chicago police officers have tested positive for COVID-19, and a total of three have passed away. So that's the first layer of an environment coming into a new job that just kind of jumps off the page at you. And then a month later, the incident related to George Floyd's death happens in Minneapolis, and unprecedented civil unrest happens. And we begin to see unprecedented violence, not just here in Chicago, but in all of our major cities throughout the country. Some apart, paired with the protests, and others just standalone unprecedented violence that we haven't seen in decades in many cities, particularly Chicago. So that is the environment I came into. And I know many of your listeners today are from the business community, and they'll understand this. So we had gone through a major reorganization of the Chicago Police Department as I'm being hired. So the interim superintendent does a major reorganization of the department, and that's still not fully implemented as I start. In the coming weeks, I fully implement it in the first parts of May, and almost immediately, I understand, along with people in the community, that that's an outdated reorganization because of what's changed on the ground. The civil unrest, the pushback against police, COVID-19, and unprecedented violence. So I have to start planning another reorganization in order to deal with what is at hand.
I know one of the pieces of that is this critical incident response team. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. So if you've watched the news and watched some of these protests, all protests have not been created equal. Many have been very peaceful. I would argue the majority. There's been a small faction of the crowd protesting that absolutely had no intent of peacefully protesting.
All right. Can I just stop you right there, Superintendent? Who are they? They're organized. Where are they coming from?
Many out of state. Many come in, agitate the crowd, get the violence and the property destruction started, and then they leave as now this mob has been spurned to interact in a negative way with the police. So they are very strategic, very cold and calculating in what they're doing, both destroying property and attacking police. There's various intelligence briefings on who they are. They're not all the same every time. Some are from the neighboring parts of Illinois, and some are from as far away as the West Coast and East Coast areas. So we don't have a lot of information about who this is. We have made some arrests. Some have faced federal charges. Some are lone wolves who are doing this kind of violence. And some have a group of people that they inspire to do this violence. So it's all across the board. Well, it really is.
This is a chaotic time, period. It's chaotic. We don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. And then to have these folks coming in and creating that kind of a problem on top of what's already there is very destabilizing. I know that's their intent, but I think there are so many questions we have in the press. Who are they? Can they be stopped?
Yes. So you ask about what is the critical incident response team? What is that? That's a dedicated group of officers that are specially trained for what we just described. We're going to specially train them as 200 officers that are dedicated to our downtown area where the protests have been occurring for the most part, that are being trained on Fourth Amendment, on First Amendment, being trained on emergency mobilization and crowd control, particularly the crowds when they turn violent. And so they work as a team, a 200 officer team, because as you've seen, these are not small crowds. And they spur a mob. It turns into a mob. And the whole mob process of if 20 people throw things at the police, now you get 100 people throwing things at the police. And pretty soon, everyone in the crowd is following the mob action of throwing things at the police. And it can be a very volatile, very dangerous situation. So that group of officers, the critical incident response team, is dedicated to controlling that crowd and earlier than before it gets to this mob reaction.
Like what we saw at the Columbus statue. That's what you're trying to head off?
Yes, anticipating that there may be some likely in the crowd that's there for the very reason of causing harm to officers and destruction to property, including looting, as we've seen in our retail areas.
Is that part of the play for these guys, that they want to create a distraction so that the looting teams, because we know we saw that in that first Saturday in the end of May.
Yes, exactly. You see it happening as our officers are moving toward controlling the crowd. This organized retail group of thieves come on our retail areas and starting just looting, knowing that the officers have been distracted. So we needed a big enough team to be able to do both, to deal with the crowd and protect our retail areas.
So speaking of retail areas, just yesterday there was a brazen shooting on Oak Street, one of the most important retail areas in the nation. What are we going to do about that?
It is. And one of the things that this 200 officer group of what I just described will be tasked with doing is being on fixed post and walking beats. Now, this is, 2 weeks in a deployment. So they just became operational 2 weeks ago. And we were just starting our foot patrols in our downtown areas, and we just basically escalated it to the immediately start walking the Magic Mile, the Gold Coast, and other areas where the shooting occurred, just to be in a deterrent. Now, our officers are not bulletproof. You know, in this last week, we've had 4 officers shot, 1 this morning and 3 just a few days ago. So we're not bulletproof, but we do add a level of deterrence to this kind of activity in our important downtown areas.
Right. Is it important to have other resources here? There's been a lot of debate nationally about whether federal agents, troops, as some people are calling them, but I think that's, and you can talk to that issue about what these folks actually do. Do we need more federal help or Illinois State Police help or even Cook County Sheriff's Police help? Because I know you have been aided by them on the west side. There's a unit that is part of the patrol out there. What else do you need as superintendent?
If you don't mind, I'll kill 2 birds with 1 stone on this question. So let me juxtapose the answer with the defund the police movement, along with do I need additional federal help or other help from the state's attorney's office? The answer is yes to both. But we got to do it all. It's not a choice of either or. It's not Chicago PD on their own or federal help. It's a collaboration of all of the above, that we need federal help because some people need to be prosecuted at the federal level so that their criminal networks can be held accountable to the fullest extent, which in the federal system is much more punitive than it would be at the state system. But we also need state's attorney's office to hold violent offenders more foot to the fire than they have been, particularly illegal gun possessors. While at the same time, this defund the police movement is about providing more investment in underserved communities. But you don't take money from sorely needed officers to do that. You just have to do both. You have to provide the social services needed in these traditionally, historically underfunded communities, and keep the level of police there to protect people from violent offenders. So I just wanted to try to kill 2 birds with 1 stone. We need all of it, working together in collaboration, more social services, officers on the beat, in the neighborhoods, federal partnerships, and state's attorneys help to hold people more accountable to commit violent crime.
We have a question coming in from Dan Hinkle of the Chicago Tribune. And this is about that critical response team, critical incident team that we were just talking about. The Chicago Police citywide mobile teams, as well as what they used to call the gun teams, right? And or citywide mobile teams, which I know are also part of the strategy here. And you can articulate that for us. But they've been involved. I'll just recap this for them. They've been in the past, there have been teams like that that have been involved in all kinds of other problems, civil rights violations, corrupt violations, you know, shaking down people for cash. What changes has the Chicago Police Department made in terms of monitoring itself to ensure that that stuff doesn't happen?
So one of the things that's significantly different, I've heard that narrative, why do this again? This is old hat and it didn't work then, it doesn't work now. We're under a consent decree. We weren't under a consent decree when these teams were providing the wrong type of policing. And we've made the point on these teams, these citywide teams, to be forward-facing in the community policing, to do community service projects in the community, get to know the community, and also protect the community. And you can't have one without the other. I think community policing actually comes first before you put anyone in jail. You have to know who's in jail, help you solve crimes when they are committed, if the community trusts you. So you have to build trust in the community first, and then you are more successful at protecting communities. So that wasn't the narrative before any citywide teams. And I understand that, you know, particularly reporters that's covered this seem so jaded that you can't do it this way. But I would argue large teams are sorely needed given the level of violence, that officers, again, are not bulletproof. And so we need enough officers to really protect these communities first, to engage them in a community policing forward-facing effort, but to also put violent offenders in jail that we all should be protected from.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about community policing. That means different things to different people. It's been identified, it's been described, it's been utilized in a lot of different ways. What does it mean to you?
Interacting with young people, especially. So if I were to reimagine CAPS, the CAPS program, which is an old program here that's likely lost its way some, that need to be reimagined. You need to have programs around young people. The younger, the better. Shaping their worldviews of policing, shaping their worldviews of building trust between the collaboration of the community. When you help a young person mentor or help them in a sports athletic team through Police Athletic League, or you help them rediscover their talents, help mentor them in school, I think you bring the family along to, who all appreciates someone doing something for their child, everyone. And so if we were to really focus our attention on particularly the underserved communities, West Side, South Side in Chicago, on young people and building a relationship between police officers and young people, that means to me you're building trust with the family. And that is a strategy that has worked in the past from my personal experience here and in other cities.
Yeah. Well, we do have an almost intractable gang problem here. The gang network, which the University of Chicago articulated that 100 years ago. They started that research project in 1919 to look at gang structures in Chicago. And so little has changed in 100 years. And you do have this inculcation of young boys specifically, starting when they're 8 years old, 10 years old, 12 years old. By the time they're 12, they have either committed a crime or are about to. They may have a weapon. Just a few weeks ago, right, we had a 12-year-old pulled out of a carjacking situation, right, who was one of the carjackers, an armed carjacker. And when you have something like that, how do you get to the community when the kids are going to see the lure of the people on the street who are saying to them, join us, you'll be safe, or join us and we won't kill you, versus police who are going to maybe shoot hoops with them or take them for a walk, whatever it happens to be?
So one of the things that I've been really making the point in this area that you're bringing up, how do we convince our young people to make different decisions than the decision to go into gangs or other criminal activity versus, kids who are in very supportive communities where the family structure is in place and maybe there's job opportunities for you and your family members, or there's some business that will hire you in a summer internship. I mean, the same thing that works in other communities that are not seeing the type of gang activity that we are seeing in some neighborhoods in Chicago will work in these same neighborhoods. The opportunity to have a job. Most of these kids are making this choice. Put aside personal responsibility, because I do believe in personal responsibility in your choices. But say they had other opportunities that you don't see in these neighborhoods for jobs, for job training, for other social services, whether that be trauma, therapy. Say you had those pieces already in place. Now, that wouldn't come through the police department. That would come through other social services and maybe even some business community interaction with these neighborhoods to provide these young people that choice when they're 10 or 11 or 12, trying to decide, you know, do I help feed my family who's hand to mouth, or do I go do something on this corner and sell drugs and make $100 a day? I mean, those are the real choices. It's not really a choice of being a millionaire on this corner. It's the choice of I make enough money to have something to eat today. And it's the wrong choice, and there should be some personal responsibility behind that choice. But can Chicago offer these young people different choices by its investment in these communities is the real question. It's not a policing solution, because we would come in and really make the problem worse through some type of mass incarceration strategy. Once you get in that cycle, you're in and out of jail. It's a revolving door. Right. It's not a solution to the choice these young people make.
Do you think that criminal justice reform this spring has led to the rise in violence and in crime throughout the United States? So there's more people coming out that essentially is their job to be violent or to be a criminal, and they just came back to do it again?
Let me start by answering in this way. Mass incarceration didn't work in the 80s and 90s. It didn't make us any safer. And the pendulum can swing too far and overcorrect for that mistake that was made. And I think that we are in that point where there's been an overcorrection. When you start letting violent offenders out, not low-level crimes, not property crimes, violent offenders out of jail, and back into these same communities, the pendulum has swung too far and you overcorrected. I would hope for some moderate corrections back toward the center of this debate. Not back to mass incarceration role, but somewhere moving toward the middle of this conversation between who stays incarcerated and who is let out free. Violent offenders just should not be a part of this conversation, in my opinion.
We see
the results of this.
Yeah, and I think we are actually seeing practical results here, because we do, in our side of the business, we are covering stories in which people who have been let out in the last number of months out of prison have just committed another crime, a heinous crime. And that's, I think, very also disconcerting. It's also destabilizing to the community, because we're just not sure what to believe here. I'm going to get a couple more questions in. Your relationship with the FOP president, the new FOP president, how's that?
Well, one thing I think is really important, that you have to have some cooler heads and the relationships between unions and the city and the police department. I've taken on the role of trying to be the cooler head, the person that interacts and tries to pull whatever we can agree on out so that we can move forward with the relationship. So far, so good. Fingers crossed. John and I have found common ground. As strange as that seems, I believe the officers need a contract. I believe the officers need a raise. I believe there are some labor issues that we can agree on. There's obviously some things we just totally won't agree on. We just disagree. I try to be apolitical. I don't think that that's a healthy conversation with John. And I just want to move the ball forward and make sure I don't get distracted from dealing with reducing violence in the city based on some political commentary. That to me is not productive at this point.
Do you need more police officers?
Chicago went through quite a bit of a hiring of officers here in the last several years, and it was sorely needed. At some point, though, you have to utilize the officers you have better. And that's where we are. We're budgeted for 13,500. We have to manage that number better. And that's about restructuring where you have enough officers to deal with the violence, to deal with the civil unrest, and to deal with some of the organized retail thieves that take advantage of both. And that's kind of where I stand. We also need more social services in certain areas of our city that we haven't invested in for generations. And I think everyone acknowledges that. If you just drive down some of the west side and south side streets, you would recognize that being a reality. So we have to do both. We have to walk and chew gum. We have to do both. We have to try to figure out a way to find the balance.
As an African-American man who's spent his entire life in local law enforcement, his career in local law enforcement, the numbers of African-American recruits are at a modern all-time low. We used to have recruits, people taking the exam to get on the job, in about exact proportion to what the racial makeup was of the city. It's no longer that case. Whereas African Americans make up 42-ish% of the population of Chicago, they're now in the mid to low 20s in terms of applications to the police department. What does that tell you?
That I, for one, need to do a better job of convincing people of color that this is a worthwhile profession. And here's one of the ways I have tried to have this conversation. Based on my experience, I make the case that the inside game for changing society has been so rewarding, much more than just protesting something you don't like about society. Being involved in government, particularly policing, can be the most significant change you can make. That the diversity that's needed in policing to have better relationships and better outcomes has been the game I chose. Rather than just complain about what's happening, I chose to be part of the solution of what's happening. And it hadn't been an easy path, but it's been so rewarding to see the change you can make from inside government as opposed to the change that's obviously can be made from just, you know, pushing government to change from the outside. So that's the case I make with young people. Here in Chicago, there is a great program in Chicago Public Schools that Dr. Jackson has put forth that I hope to grow. It's a cadet program where young people of color who aspire to be police officers from middle school, elementary school, are groomed and mentored. And that could be like a little bit of a feeder system like AAA in baseball to becoming police officers. And we need to pour into that program and grow it. There's a small stipend these young people receive. We should give them more of a stipend. We should mentor them even more, increase the capacity so that we can have a AAA club of police officers from black and brown communities in this city.
John Colletti, a Chicago businessman, is asking the question, what can the business community, and he runs it from the Gibson's Group, runs a major business in downtown Chicago, what can the business community actually do to help the police department?
I'm going to start with the easy answer. Number one, when you see a police officer, thank them for their service. It's a thankless job. We never hear thank you. Particularly today. It's actually hard to say thank you because sometimes you get into an argument about supporting police, given the defund the police movement. That's number one. Thank the police officer when you see them for their service. Number two, I think what we need to hear from the business community are business solutions to some of our challenges. I would love to convene a group, maybe from this group, of thought leaders on solutions to some of the challenges we face. Much of our solutions are no different than any other business solution. Whether you're in selling products or manufacturing phones. I mean, it's similar business processes that we struggle with, particularly computer processes, project management issues. I mean, we have similar issues, and we look for those relationships with the business community to help us find the best solution. So I would love to convene maybe an executive team of thought leaders Number two, if you have any philanthropic opportunities with your business, I would say support the Police Foundation, support the Police Memorial Foundation, because that's where you can bring in immediate help where our budgets are limited, mostly salaries, for equipment that we otherwise couldn't afford that we need to protect our officers if you're so inclined. And so there are several ways. Start with thank you when you see an officer. I would say offer business solutions to us on common problems we have being a business. And again, if you have any philanthropy in your heart, officers always need protective equipment to help us do our job.
Yeah, I think many people don't realize that Chicago police officers are required to buy their own bulletproof vests. And that's what the Chicago Police Memorial Foundation's Get Behind the Vest program is about, is making sure that those officers don't have to pay for that, that those that we as the citizens, the contributors to that fund, pay for those vests. And we've been able to – and vests expire, too. People don't realize that. And that's an important thing. And now I think we're in our – we've outfitted the entire Chicago Police Department, and now we're starting the second generation because of the expired vests that we – the first ones we bought. So CPMF, the Chicago Police Memorial – Foundation, just Google it and you can find it and you can find that program. So thank you for mentioning that. All right. So this is from a woman named Kathleen. She says, what can we do as citizens to help protect or alert to trouble? She says she calls 911 and when she sees trouble, but they seem overwhelmed. And I think that's an interesting circumstance that we have here. You do get the 911 system getting overwhelmed by people in more stable neighborhoods who are seeing any sign of trouble and underwhelmed by folks who don't want to call 911 except they want to get ambulance service as opposed to police service after something really bad has happened.
So one of the things that it has been really smart with this challenge of getting police service on issues in your neighborhood where you live on your street is the block clubs or the neighborhood groups. And they interact with our CAPS program and they get more immediate problem solving. Many of the issues that you would call 911 about are longstanding issues that have a root cause. And the 911 call just deals with the surface, just answers the call, makes the report, but it never gets to the root cause of the problem. Block clubs or neighborhood groups interacting with CAPS officers are problem-solving officers who get to the solutions that cause the 911 call. And so you eliminate the root cause, the 911 call goes away. So those interactions are weekly, daily, monthly, wherever they need to be to solve the problem. So I would argue become a member of a city block, of your city block club or neighborhood group, interact with our CAPS, and let's get to the root causes of the problems that you would otherwise call 911 for.
Let's talk about guns here. We do have a question from Jonathan Arthur, and I'm going to follow up with this. There are these groups that want to void the FOID. They want to change the laws in Illinois so that you don't have to have a license to purchase a gun nor to conceal carry. And that's been a question a lot of people. You come from Texas where it's very easy to access guns. The question that Mr. Arthur has is how do we keep this from being the Wild West if that were to actually occur? We'll start with that. Then I want to ask you about ghost guns because we've got a question from the WGN radio newsroom about that.
Sure. So I think you started, alluded to some of the answer that I'm going to give. Breaking news, we got a gang problem in Chicago. And access to guns makes that gang problem, makes us all unsafe, no matter where you are in the city. It is localized. The gang issues are localized to the south and west sides. But as you saw just yesterday, if a gang member is doing something on social media live, and runs into another opposing gang member, they meet out their violence right there. And they don't wait till they get back to the neighborhood. So, number one, I think the gun issues, relaxing gun laws in this area, you have to think about your access to guns for gang members who already don't follow the law. They buy illegal guns. Do you want those gun laws relaxed? My vote would be no. I know I don't have the only vote, but my vote will be no. We don't want easier access by criminals to guns in Chicago, given the gang violence that we see that's really unprecedented anywhere else in the country. So that's my answer. My vote is no on easier gun laws. And yes, I am from Texas where damn near everybody's born with a gun, but we don't have the entrenched generational gang conflicts that you have here in Chicago and Texas. That makes it unique.
Right. Well, I mean, you're alluding to something that's important there, too, which is there is a gang subculture, and there's families that are born from gangs, and then they give birth to future gang members because that's the family business. And the recruitment tools and the drug trade and all of those things, it's organized crime's been around as long as crime has been around on some level. But Chicago has, as you just pointed out, a really entrenched subculture.
Yeah.
How does the police department change that? Can they change it?
One of our more significant strategies that really began day one with me on the job was looking at a faster track on criminal network conspiracy investigations. So normally the track of trying to prove a conspiracy, which is two or more people conspiring to sell drugs or kill someone, takes years. You know, you have to get up on a wire. You have to do surveillance, both video and audio surveillance. You have to put cases together to prove the conspiracy, which takes 2 years or more. But there is also a near-term criminal network investigation that Chicago was very good at back in the day that they just stopped doing. And so we started up. Now, that takes federal partnerships to do. So John Losh with the U.S. Attorney's Office have been a great partner. John Losh, great partner. And we collaborated on reinvigorating the near-term, called mid-level, criminal network conspiracy cases against our gangs here. We need to do 10s, 20s, 30s of those a year, 10 to 20 to 30 of those a year, and that's federal time, and that's 15 years or more minimum if you prove those conspiracies, and that's more than one gangster off the street.
Right.
And those cases sends chills down the spine of our gangsters here. So that's already started. That started day one of my tenure here as superintendent. I saw that as a deficiency in dealing with our gang violence and our gang and drug culture, the 3 month to 6 month, and get them all rolling where one comes up every month or two comes up every month, three comes up every month, so that you really have a federal outcome, more than just the state's attorney outcome, the federal outcome of day for day time in the federal pen, 15 years or more, and you're sent somewhere outside our state. So,
Michael Sennett has a question specifically about DHS, ICE, Border Patrol agents patrolling the streets of Chicago, and his concern is keeping them out of sight, reducing the incidence of violence and abusive tactics against more aggressive but still largely peaceful protests, as he puts it right there. What is your thought on that?
Not happening in Chicago. We made that point. And we are not getting DHA and our ICE patrolling the streets of Chicago. We are getting federal agents helping with the cases I just mentioned, criminal network conspiracies, investigations. That's the only help we're getting from the feds. It's the help we think it can be most productive. The help on the ground is not productive. It's not helpful. It's actually more harmful. Look at Portland. It's been more harmful. And we did not, nor will we, get those kind of resources.
I want to go back to guns here for a moment because we did leave something on the table there. I brought up ghost guns. This is people being able to legally buy parts of guns on the internet and then assembling them, 80% of them, and then they get the rest of it off the black market. And these have no traceable items in them. You can't prove they weren't purchased. They aren't part of that trail that identifies guns and does ballistic checks and all of that. Pretty dangerous, and they do seem to be popping up all over the country. Are you seeing them here in Chicago?
We likely do. We don't have any cases that come front of mind that we've prosecuted in that area. And I would just emphasize what you just said. This is a very dangerous, dangerous thing that's prominent on the internet, being able to assemble guns that you can't trace so that you can commit crimes and no one can be held accountable because you can't trace. We need some federal gun laws to solve some of these issues. It's not a state's solution only. As you can see, our surrounding states don't have the same gun laws that Chicago and Illinois has. So we need to have some federal solutions to some of these very challenging workarounds to get a gun.
Reverend Randall Blakey writes, good afternoon, Superintendent. Can you speak to the importance of community involvement in solving crimes? The example of the Near North community that assisted in the Janari Ricks murder investigation last week.
So I'm going to go back to my government class in high school where my government teacher, Miss Battle, said, this is a participatory democracy, son. You have to participate in this democracy to make it work. This is not a spectator sport. Our local democracy is not a spectator sport, she would emphasize. I never forgot that. And it is so true today. Is complaining and standing on the sideline about what government is not doing and not being involved is not helpful. It doesn't lead to better outcomes, nor does it help us all be any safer when it comes to policing. And the Janari Ricks murder being solved so soon is a testament to that reality, that is participatory democracy, that these people in the community came forward and gave us information, gave us tips our investigators could use to charge Janari's killer. And if we did that throughout Chicago, particularly on the west and south side, and didn't let these gangsters intimidate us not to come forward, we would not see the level of violence that we're seeing, because they would be afraid to commit crimes. They don't want to go to jail. They just believe that no one will turn them in, because that is the reality. No one turns these people in. If we change that, we would be safer.
But how do we ensure the safety of those who are going to cooperate?
Two answers. Janari's killer is off the street and that neighborhood is safer because they came forward. If they had not come forward, they would be less safe. So number one, I push back on the argument that coming forward makes you less safe. No, not coming forward leaves the killers to kill again. But part two of the answer is yes, these gangsters threaten witnesses. And they are emboldened to continue to commit crime because they know they have put fear in the hearts of people who would come forward. So I've been repeatedly saying this, and thank you for the opportunity to say this, is that our federal partners have a witness protection program here. It's run by the U.S. Marshals here. And you qualify if you have information on murders, especially, can be protected, relocated. In that federal witness protection system. So there is a system there through the U.S. Marshals. I would just say, come forward. You'll be safer.
Do you have to leave Chicago for that? I'm sorry, Superintendent.
Excuse me?
Do you have to leave Chicago?
No, you don't have to.
Okay.
You don't have to. That's likely one of the things that will be offered, but mm-hmm. You don't have to leave Chicago.
Okay.
And you're made safer by coming forward through either path.
Okay.
Come forward without the witness protection. Come forward with witness protection, but come forward with information to solve violence.
John Napier writes us, the combination of COVID, BLM, Antifa, warm weather, perfect storm for violence. Numbers of shootings have skyrocketed. What changes are being made to address the increase in lethal violence? We've addressed some of that, but I want to kind of go to this perfect mix. Do you agree with that this is a perfect mix?
I do agree with pandemic, civil unrest, and unprecedented violence. And let me make sure I make the connection. I'm lesser believing Antifa and BLM has led to violence. Here's where the pandemic's impact's probably not fully appreciated here. So we couldn't continue to put people in jail at the same levels because of the pandemic and the risk of them catching COVID, and it'd be a population of COVID explosion in our jails. So our jails were basically emptied out. So people that would normally be in jail haven't been in jail since March. Our jail population is here in Cook County is down to 4,600 people. It's been as high as 10,000.
Right.
10,000 is likely too high, but 4,000 is likely too low. And many of those that have been released because of COVID from jail are violent offenders. And so I had a neighborhood say this to me, and I just want to share what they said about this dynamic of COVID and jails and the small populations. Don't let the rights of the offender supersede the rights of the victims. We think too much of the rights of the offender, and we think too little of the rights, the constitutional rights of people for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And these violent offenders are let out to protect their rights, and sometimes for bail and bond and their rights of being healthy, not catching COVID, and they get out of jail and kill someone. And many neighbors are neighborhood people are coming to me saying, can we make the case that our rights are important too? And the rights of the offenders shouldn't supersede ours. So I just want to make that case for people on the West and South Side that make that case to me.
Yeah. In terms of the clearance rate, this goes hand in hand with that. The murder clearance rate in Chicago is pretty low, and it's at all-time lows really over the last 2 years, which predates COVID and predates the emptying of the jails, although it does coincide with the criminal justice reform movement. Are those two things related? What can the Chicago Police Department do? What can you do as superintendent to up that clearance rate, to find and convict the people who actually did these murders?
Number one, there was a growing of the investigative units here several years back, particularly the homicide units, based on a PERF study, a study by an executive police group that said we have too few homicide investigators, especially. And so we grew. And so new people became homicide detectives who don't have the experience. And it takes time to become a really functioning, you know, exceptional homicide detective. Number one. Number two, we can do a lot better at training our homicide detectives. A lot more advanced training needs to happen. We've started that as well, giving more advanced training in homicide investigations. Number two, we are not very diverse in our homicide and total investigative units. So people of color, are they likely to come forward or be more comfortable talking with someone that looks like them or not? That's one case to be made. Another case to be made is, can we move forward with convincing people to come forward with information to solve the crimes and not be fearful of retaliation, either through witness protection or to convincing people that you're safer when killers are charged and convicted. Either way, all of those components have to improve.
Is that
regardless of how you look at it?
Is that internal training or external training that they're getting? That's new and additional.
We want to bring in. Obviously, we have internal training, but we want to bring in more subject matter expertise in homicide and other investigations to impart that knowledge and wisdom on our investigative teams, particularly homicide. So both, we need to do both more internal training and outside subject matter expertise training.
This is an interesting question, obviously coming from somebody who's a police officer, a police family. Superintendent, can you please explain the general order relating to First Amendment and police action, G-0202, in your opinion, are there not officers violating people's constitutional rights since the police consent decree has been in effect?
I would just make the case here that there likely are some people we shouldn't hire. And there likely are some people we hired that lost their way. But let me use the example of the recent civil unrest. So we had to deploy a whole department related to the end of May's events, where we had looting and just widespread violence. So 13,000 cops were mobilized to protect the city. And we received some 800 complaints. So one way to look at it is to just say, that's a lot of complaints against officers and their misconduct as it relates to protecting First Amendment. 800 is a lot. I would argue, yes, it is a lot, but more than 90% of the officers did the job exactly like we want them. So I'm not making excuses for the 800 that didn't do the job right. We're going to hold them accountable. They'll be investigated. If they're found to be true, we're going to discipline them. But I also don't want it to be lost. There were 99% of the officers did not get complained on, did the job in an admirable way, and we ought to applaud them as much as we discipline the officers that did.
We're running out of time here, and I do want to get to the idea or the issue of keeping police officers healthy mentally. This is a big, big issue. Just had a suicide within the last week, and the police department actually at a police facility. And I just want to tell a quick story, and I think that it elucidates a lot of what happens. I was talking to, right after the civil unrest, I ran into and did what you mentioned earlier. I walked up to two police sergeants who were in white shirts, and they were walking down Michigan Avenue, and I thanked them for their service, and I engaged them in a conversation. And one of them said to me, and I thought this was kind of interesting, said, you know, we lost downtown. Our whole reason for being is not to lose downtown. That's the one thing that we need to protect. It's harder to protect the neighborhoods in a lot of ways. Downtown's a little bit easier in some, as he was explaining it, in some tactical way, because there are ways you can do bridges and other ways you can shut it off.
Yep.
But the expression on his face and the timbre of his voice was such disappointment. And I wonder how much these last couple of months, whether it's through COVID or through the civil unrest and through the skyrocketing murders here, have disheartened these men and women, these 13,500 men and women on the job, and what can we do about it?
Yeah, and add on 700 of our officers have tested positive for COVID. Add on more than 10 of our officers have been shot at and shot this year. So it's a dangerous job, even more dangerous in a pandemic, and even more complex given civil unrest, what happened to George Floyd, and the defund the police movement. So it's a lot of layers of complexity. And I would just, I know we're running out of time, but I would just end my answer with this. So, and I want to directly to any cops that you know are listening. The best cops live balanced lives. They spend time with their family. They spend time with their hobbies. If they're people of faith, they spend time in their church, and they do the job. They don't just try to be cops 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That leads to officers not being well. That leads to what we see when we do see officer suicide. More officers in this country commit suicide than die by in the line of duty deaths every year. Again, the best cops live balanced lives.
Yeah, that, and that number, by the way, is exponential, the difference between losing their life on the job and taking their own life, which tells you about, you know, how serious this is. And I know that it also reflects in the police work on the street, does it not?
It does. It really does. And there's no shame in seeking out someone to talk with, whether that's a peer or a professional. That there should be no shame. We're not supermen and superwomen. We are people doing a very difficult, complex job, and it has its effects on us seeing that kind of trauma day in and day out, people at their worst. So, again, there's no shame, no shame at all in seeking out someone to talk with.
I want to end on a good note here, a couple of good notes. A couple of 2 weeks ago when the mass shooting happened on 79th Street, I was talking to Father Flager on WGN, and he talked about an idea that has been working around that neighborhood, which is a pretty good one, trying to get the Ring camera people to come in and make sure that we get Ring cameras on those blocks, get a number of them, trying to talk to Comcast about making sure that there's internet for those. Are you supportive of that?
Very supportive of it. It can't be led by police because of privacy issues. Father Flager is the perfect person to lead this charge. We've tried to make some connections between the Ring executive leadership team and Father Flager. We think we've got a connection being made. We want to support that issue 100-fold.
That would help with all of this, the clearance rates and all of the above.
Yes.
Getting people off
yes,
the street.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. And I guess my final question for you, Superintendent, again, thank you for spending an hour with us. You're a busy man. We understand. What has been your happiest moment so far in these 100 days on the job?
Number one, the best pizza cut in squares that I've ever tasted. We cut it in slices, like the East Coast. But man, some great pizza. And oh my God, you guys, I don't know. I'm adopted now, Chicago, but the lake is just a treasure. It is just a treasure. The views and the backdrop of the lake on the trails is just gorgeous every day. And I, for one, would do everything I can to help protect this great city, this great American city.
Superintendent, thank you very much. Superintendent David Brown, Chicago Police Department. And again, it could not be tougher. My entire life, growing up, living in the city, I've never seen it quite like this. You've stepped into a very, very, very difficult circumstance, and you've stood a lot of fire, sir. So I appreciate what you're trying to do, as
thank
we
you,
all
bro.
Do. Thank you.
Great to meet you. Thank you. Take care.
All right.